with idea. So would you do that, please?
All right. Could you tell me what is the order that you decided, Jorge?
I didn't decide an order.
Okay.
Decide an order with me for John.
So, is Jonathan the first?
Yes.
So, today we're going to have this panel on loop quantum cosmology and symmetry reduction, basically about recent, by that I mean last couple of years, developments on relating loop quantum gravity with loop quantum cosmology. And we've got three speakers, Jonathan Engel, Christian Fleischack, and Emmanuel Alessi. And the idea is that each of them will give roughly 15 minutes talk. We'll have very short questions in between, just directed to very specifically to some issues that that speaker has actually raised. It's best not to raise questions during the talk so that they can finish in 15 minutes each. And then at the end of it, so after about 50 minutes or so, we'll still have another 15, 20 minutes for general discussion. Okay, so Jonathan, can you start?
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry, I'm using someone else's computer, and they have to tell me how to change slides. Okay, what did I do? What did you do? Okay, that's what I was trying. Okay, good. All right. So I was asked to give a broad picture and some background. So I try to give the way I see what's been done over the last year. And then Christian and Emanuele will give some more detailed explanations. So the first slide after the title slide, I have this diagram, which you've probably often seen. So the idea is we want some quantum cosmological models we can start comparing loop quantum gravity with potential observations in the cosmological context. And one way of arriving at such a cosmological model is by first classically symmetry reducing and then applying methods from loop quantum gravity. And this is what gives rise to loop quantum cosmology. But you can also try to first quantize the full theory and then impose some sort of quantum symmetry reduction method, so doing some symmetry reduction at the full quantum level. And these are two different paths. Sometimes people will think that the path where you first quantize and then reduce is more trustworthy or more fundamental or something like this. But I take a viewpoint that really both paths are important. Each path has its advantages and also questions. And really, if one can get as much agreement as possible with these two paths, you really can get more confidence in the final cosmological model. Next slide, please. So when I first started thinking about these issues a while back, I oftentimes heard people say that they don't see how it's possible that a mini superspace model, where you first symmetry reduce and then quantize, how that could ever tell you anything about what's going on in the full theory. But what I found in the research I did in 2006 is that really there's no conceptual reason, there's no basic conceptual reason that would prevent a mini superspace quantization from really telling you something about the physics of the full theory. What I was investigating back in 2006 was a free scalar field theory, which is a very simple theory, but that's enough to get a proof of concept. And in that simple theory, I was able to show that both whether you symmetry reduce first or you quantize first, as long as you quantize in the same way, the two ways match, even with dynamics. And so the lesson that I learned from this is that if there is some disagreement between the mini superspace model and what you would get from the full theory, it's either because there's some difference in the quantization strategy used or something subtlety arising from the fact that you have nonlinear dynamics or a nonlinearity in the definition of the kinematics of the theory. But at a basic conceptual level, it should work to some extent. Next slide, please. One thing I learned in that research is that it's important that when you symmetry reduce the full quantum theory, this is not done by simply imposing invariance of your quantum state under an action of the symmetry group. This is especially clear in quantum gravity because all physical states in quantum gravity are invariant under all diffeomorphisms. And in particular, that means they're going to be invariant under all possible symmetry groups. So that once you have your space of physical state, this sort of symmetry condition is vacuous. It has no content. So it's clear this is not how you are symmetry reduce at the quantum level. Rather, what you need to do is you need to do what you always do when you take a classical condition and make it quantum. First, you write down the classical equations which express the symmetry and you quantize them. So in the case of the scalar field theory, if you just write down that the lead derivative of the scalar field and the lead derivative of its momentum with respect to the Killing vector field are zero, that gives you two equations, and you can quantize them. Immediately you have a subtlety because you can't really impose them simultaneously because they're second class. And so you have to use some other method which would be appropriate for second class constraints, either some Gupta-Bleuler method where you combine the configuration of momenta into some sort of annihilation operator, some sort of complexified field, or you can also use Thomas Thiemann's master constraint method, or you can consider some family of coherent states and impose the symmetry constraint on the labels, consider the span of those coherent states. And in a simple case, these actually are equivalent to each other, these different ways of imposing these second-class symmetry constraints. But this is one of the main complications of symmetry reduction of the full quantum theory, is that there's an inherent ambiguity in any of these methods that when you're imposing second-class constraints. So if you do the Gupta-Bleuler method, there's an ambiguity in the choice of annihilation operator, which in this equation that I've written there, it's the choice of this lambda. And also when you construct the master constraint, there's a measure which you need to choose in constructing the master constraint, and that's an ambiguity. And also there, you can have different families of coherent states. So there's this inherent ambiguity, which as far as I know, there's no way around it if you're trying to impose symmetry at the full quantum level. But one interesting note is that in the simple case of the scalar field, I found that the ambiguity is essentially fixed by the condition that the space of symmetric states be invariant under the dynamics. So the condition of compatibility with dynamics was enough to get rid of the ambiguity. So this ambiguity actually might be important in order to really relate the reduced and full theories, including dynamics, which it's not something which I think should be ignored. It's important to note the ambiguity and perhaps even use it. So with that, with those clarifications behind us, let's go to the next slide. So we can summarize very briefly what I see as the advantages or disadvantages or questions, rather, that's probably better than disadvantage. So of the mini superspace method, the clear advantage is that it's simpler, and you can carry out the quantization to completion. In LQC, you can construct a complete set of Dirac observables. You can solve the diffeomorphism constraint. And this is really why with LQC, we can finally start to make contact with potential cosmological observations, because we can really complete the quantization program. The disadvantage is that we don't have a direct proof that this represents full LQG. Faithfully, we expect it does to some extent, and it's difficult to say exactly what represents the full theory and in what way. That's the disadvantage. But then also, if you want to symmetry reduce the full quantum theory, that also has advantages and disadvantages. Obviously, the advantage is that you know what you have is clearly reflective of the full theory. But the disadvantage is there are open issues in the full theory. People disagree about the way the Hamiltonian constraint should be quantized. And as I mentioned on the previous slide, there's this inherent ambiguity in how you impose symmetry in the full theory, because they're second-class constraints. Next slide, please. So another note here is we're not really going to be talking about spin foam dynamics in this panel. But really, whether you use the canonical dynamics or the spin foam dynamics, this really has to do with the dynamics only. So roughly speaking, the first part of this talk that Christian is going to talk about, and also much of what I'm going to talk about, really has to do with kinematics. And so you could really, it's not really an issue of whether you use canonical versus spin foam. Our discussions of the kinematics really applies to independently of whether you use canonical dynamics or spin foam dynamics. One thing that I noticed, as far as I can see, that the work in spin foam cosmology hasn't really tried to make contact with LQC. And so this is it's one open issue. I was asked to mention open issues that I saw. So one of the open issues is really not only trying to do cosmology with spin foams, but also make contact with the mini superspace model, LQC. Another note is that really I'm going to be talking about just the K equals zero homogeneous isotropic case, just for simplicity, but oftentimes things which I say will also apply to other cases, other homogeneous symmetry groups. Next slide, please. So now I want to talk a little bit in more detail about the issues that arise in the mini superspace method. And these really fall into two broad categories. One is how we can adapt the loop methods of quantization to the quantization of the cosmological phase space, to the FLRW phase space. And then the second is then relating it to the full theory, which is already touching upon the quantum symmetry reduction approach. Next slide, please. So to talk about how we adapt the loop quantization method to cosmology, we need a brief review of the quantization method used in loop quantum gravity. So the first important element is the basic variables. Everyone knows this. You have the Escher-Barbaro connection and conjugate electric field, and then the classical configuration space is the space of smooth SU2 connections. And then the loopiness comes in the choice of your basic algebra of configuration variables, which become well-defined operators. And the algebra is that which is generated by the parallel transports along analytic paths. And that's really the most characteristic thing about the loop quantum gravity construction. And with this algebra of configuration variables, we can construct a quantum configuration space using this Gelfand spectrum construction. So what is the Gelfand spectrum? So if you have a manifold, you can consider the algebra of continuous functions on that manifold. And the Gelfand spectrum construction is really an inverse operation. If you start from a certain algebra, which could be considered an algebra of functions, it'll tell you what would be the manifold that you need for that to be the space of continuous functions. So we start off with the algebra of configuration variables, and we construct this Gelfand spectrum, and this gives us our quantum configuration space, which is a certain compactification of the classical space. And this is useful because it allows for the construction of rigorous Borel measures. And this measure needs to be selected through some means, and the way it's done is through the condition of diffeomorphism invariance, which is a very physically well-motivated condition because you want diffeomorphisms to act unitarily in your theory. And this condition is enough to select out the Eschtekar-Lewandowski measure. And then the kinematical space of states is just the space of square integrable functions on the quantum configuration space with respect to this measure. I had all of these points about kinematics and only one point about dynamics, even though dynamics is probably the more difficult problem. But the one thing about the loop methods, the loop quantization that's used in the quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint, the one thing I want to emphasize is that curvature the curvature, which appears in the Hamiltonian constraint, is regularized using holonomies around loops. And then the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory is really used to remove the regulator and really shrink the loop to a point. There are also proposals for the Hamiltonian constraint where you don't do this, where you fix the graph and you just shrink to some minimal loop. But the one which was originally proposed by Thomas Tiemann, it was shrunk to a point. You could really remove the regulator. Next slide, please. So now, with that review, we can mention what's different in the quantization strategy that's used in LQC. So the first obvious difference is, of course, it has to be this way. The classical configuration space only includes symmetric connections. That's what we want. And the space of symmetric connections is one-dimensional, so it's parameterized by one variable c, and so this classical configuration space is isomorphic to the real line. The first real difference is really number two, that makes us a little bit uneasy sometimes, is that the basic configuration algebra that you use only includes parallel transports along straight edges. And the resulting quantum configuration space is the Bohr compactification of the real line. And the next difference is that the measure is not selected through diffeomorphism invariance, but rather through mathematical naturalness when one uses the Haar measure on the Bohr compactification. And then the last difference is really you're not really able to shrink these loops that regulate the Hamiltonian constraint. You're not able to shrink them to a point in the cosmological setting, basically because of homogeneity. So what they do is it's regularized by the curvature is regularized by a square loop, which is not shrunk into a point, but to the size of the area gap. And if we hadn't done this, there would be no area gap in LQC. It seems to be an unavoidable feature of doing a mini superspace approach, is that there's no way to get an area gap unless you put it in by hand. And so this is where it gets put in by hand into LQC. So notes about these differences. First of all, the first difference is the difference that we want. It's what makes this a mini superspace quantization. Differences 2 and 3 can actually be gotten rid of. We've been working on this. So Christian Fleischack was the one who first was able to get rid of difference number 2. So by including parallel transports along curved edges, he found that you got a different quantum configuration space. And then just recently, Maximilian, my postdoc and I, we were able to select a measure on this quantum configuration space using diffeomorphism invariance. And so we were able to address point 3 as well. And it turns out that the measure that you get is such that the resulting space of square integrable functions is isomorphic to the square integrable functions with respect to the Haar measure on the Bohr compactification. So after you correct both points 2 and 3, you end up getting the same kinematical Hilbert space that people have been using in LQC since forever, which is a very nice result. Difference number 4 is still present, but I don't know any way around this, and I can't even imagine another way around it. But it's an interesting question to see if there is some way to shed light on the difference which seems to be necessary in quantizing the Hamiltonian constraint. Next slide, please. Another issue.
Jonathan, we're running a little bit late, so you might have to speed up a little bit. Thank you.
Okay, yes, I will. Also in the relating the mini superspace model to the full theory, you can relate kinematics and dynamics, and Christian and Johannes Brunemann a while back showed that when you only use the straight edges in the definition of the configuration algebra, you end up not being able to embed the quantum configuration space. But if you look at the state spaces, there's no problem in embedding it. And so there's a lesson to be learned here that you have to be careful about partial negative results. These results about non-embeddability of configuration spaces, once you consider the state spaces, it doesn't really matter anymore. Something similar to that happened on the previous slide. Once you consider the measures on the configuration spaces and the resulting kinematical Hilbert spaces, the difference went away. So you have to be careful about a partial negative result. You have to go through the quantization before you can really make definitive statements about non-commutation of symmetry reduction and quantization. And as far as dynamics, the only work I've seen on relating LQC to the dynamics of the full theory is really Emanuele's work, and Norbert has also done some work on this, and Emanuele will talk about that later. Next slide, please. But the work that Emanuele has done really involves a gauge-fixed version of the full theory, which involves some truncation. And another thing which I'm interested in is really imposing symmetry in a diffeomorphism invariant way. It does not involve gauge fixing. And maybe because I'm running out of time, let me just skip to the next slide, which is my last. It's not quite my last slide. Let's skip to the slide after that. Chris Beadle, I, and Philip Mendonca and Matt Hogan have been recently came up with a paper which proposes a way to impose symmetry in full loop quantum gravity in a diffeomorphism invariant way, so without any gauge fixing or truncation. Of course, it's only partial. It's only a partial success. We can define the symmetry constraints, and we can prove that they imply homogeneity and isotropy, and we can quantize them on the diffeomorphism invariant Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. But this is only partial because we still have to solve these constraints. We want to solve them by actually finding an embedding of LQ space into it. But I think it's important to at least try this sort of idealistic approach, and I think it might shed light on other more practical approaches. Like one can ask, for example, does Emanuele's states that he uses, do they satisfy this constraint? I would expect they would. To some extent. And this approach has also shed some light on the relation between Bianchi-1 LQC and isotropic LQC. Abai and Ed, in their paper in 2009, had proposed a projector which projects Bianchi-1 states to isotropic states. It's a projector which commutes with the dynamics, or intertwines the dynamics. And if you just look at the adjoint of this, the adjoint gives an embedding of the isotropic model into the Bianchi-1 model. And the image of this embedding actually satisfies exactly the blue box equation up there, quantized in the most obvious way. So it really satisfies a diffeomorphism invariant version of quantum isotropy. So I think it's already shedding some light on other things going on in LQC, even if we don't completely finish this program to completion. And I'll stop there. That's enough for my section. Are you there?
Oh. We have time for just quick clarification questions. Okay, I would just like to make just two quick remarks. I mean, the very first couple of transparencies, Jonathan raised the issue about, you know, what does it even mean that the full theory and LQC could be related. So obviously they cannot be related for all observables. The question is always about if we coarse grain the full theory and just look at a few observables that are relevant to the large scale structure of space-time, so we only look at, you know, the mean density or the mean spatial curvature, which is homogeneous and isotropic, only that mode, then is there a relation between the two theories? That is the only question we can ask, and that is the most interesting question. And the second was that with dynamics, Jonathan raised a little bit of pessimism about how could the two things be related to each other. But that is because Jonathan was always looking at the very first proposal of Thomas Thiemann, in which the edge length is actually in which you add a new edge, and then you make the area of the new triangle go to zero. Whereas what one could do is also a proposal which really preserves the graph. So which Thomas later proposed. So if you actually preserve the graphs, in other words, graph preserving definition of the Hamiltonian constraint, it may be quite possible that one would be able to make a relation between the LQC idea of looking at the loops with the smallest area and not shrinking anything to zero, and the graph preserving Hamiltonian constraint idea. And as I understand it, Emanuele, Alessi, and Giafriani have ideas to go along this line. So I just wanted to make these clarifying remarks. And now we can start with Christian Fleischack, who is going to talk about canonical issues. Christian.
Yeah, thank you very much, Abhay. And, of course, congratulations to this very distinguished honor. I also would like to thank my students that they allowed me to shift my lecture I actually had to give right now. And finally, to thank Param and my co-speakers to switch these talks in order to allow me to recover. This has a big advantage because now I can already comment on John's and Max's results. So, first slide. As John has already told you, the main strategy we use for loop quantum gravity is canonical quantization a la Dirac. And there are three main ingredients. We have to choose some set of variables. Then we have to somehow quantize these variables. And then we have to implement the constraints. Typically, we do it using group averaging. And then finally, we get the Hilbert space. In principle, this is fine. Of course, the details are the most difficult issues. I would like to focus on the first choice because here we have the canonical part, and I cannot go to finally include all the constraints, for instance. So go please to the next slide. The idea to choose these separating space is in the canonical framework first to choose some algebra of functions on the configuration space. And ideally we have some sort of continuous functions. It would be nice to have them fall off at infinity, but the problem is this is only possible if we have some topology on our configuration space. And for instance, taking the set of all connections, well, there's a really huge space and topology, okay, one can define topologies, but it's quite tricky. And to have some, say, locally compact, that's really very tricky. So typically, this C0 is inappropriate, and the idea about 30 years ago almost, or 25 years ago, was to choose not continuous functions vanishing at infinity, but to take bounded functions, possibly continuous, but not necessarily continuous functions. And using this, for instance, taking as configuration space the set of all connections, then one takes all the parallel transport matrix functions, collect them in the set of cylindrical functions, they form a C-star algebra commutative, and then we can take the spectrum. And by abstract reasons, we know that the original configuration space is mapped to a dense subset of the spectrum. And this mapping is injective if the algebra is rich enough. It means it's rich enough to separate the points. And this way, finally, one defines the quantum configuration space just to be the spectrum of the algebra underlying all these things. Of course, this is a choice. Therefore, choosing different variables typically leads to different quantum configuration spaces and, of course, to maybe different quantum theories. So, for instance, if you gauge fix, this is already a change in the variables, so you need not expect to get the same theory. Okay, next slide. This is basically some sort of copy of John's slide reviewing the idea what to do with quantization and reduction. The original idea was, okay, take the embedding of the classical configuration spaces, means the cosmological in within the gravitational, or just system one within system two, and then use the completion in the quantum configuration spaces to extend this embedding to some embedding of the quantum configuration spaces. Taking then the pullback, one gets a mapping between the algebras of the basic functions, giving the variables and the fundamental entities in our theory, and then using some Gaffin triple, then an HRC to define quantum states. This was the main idea. And I want to focus on the first task, namely the issue of the embedding of the quantum configuration spaces first. So the question is, given two systems, at the right upper corner I gave the examples for loop quantum cosmology in the traditional framework and loop quantum gravity. So we have these almost periodic functions as the fundamental algebra and then the Bohr compactification. So abstractly it's just the mapping between one configuration space S1 and the second S2, and we have this natural mapping, these embeddings into the quantum space, and the question is whether the lower line between S1 bar and S2 bar exists, is unique, and continuous. And there's a quite easy criterion, namely that such a continuation, a continuous continuation, exists if and only if the restrictions of, well, more formally, the pullbacks of all functions used to define the, say, full theory, all these pullbacks have to be included in the functions we use for the symmetric theory. This immediately implies that the embedding of R, means the symmetric connections within the full connections, cannot be continuously extended to the embedding of the Bohr compactification. This was the result by Johannes and myself, John already mentioned. A simple corollary is that this extension, if it exists, then it's unique. And the, I think the most relevant theorem is that such an embedding is even injective by Stone-Weierstrass theorem, if and only if the algebra used for the cosmological theory is just the C-star algebraic completion of the pullbacks of the full theory. This means taking all the restrictions of the loop quantum gravity functions to the symmetric connections, that's the only way to get a continuous embedding of loop quantum cosmology into loop quantum gravity configuration spaces. Okay, next slide. Here I've listed all the different embeddings we have. First, the first column, have the for the different cases of piecewise analytic paths, the smooth paths, and so on, whether the classical smooth connections can be embedded within the generalized connections. And of course, if you only have a fixed graph, then it's no longer possible. But if it's green, then it's working. The main body are these pluses and minuses therein, and a plus just means that we have an extension. Of course, this is given if we take the same passes as for the full theory. However, in the other cases, usually there is no extension. Okay, next slide. Now, as we have learned how to choose the functions in order to allow this embedding, one has just to calculate all the possible matrix functions of paratransport along symmetric connections. Okay, it's quite a tricky stuff, and one ends up with the functions, the respective algebras, the is the theta algebra of all almost periodic functions on R plus the functions vanishing at infinity. Now the question is, what is the spectrum of this? And there the idea is, okay, this is C0 of x plus some unital C-star algebra, and this is quite easily, it's just the direct, the disjoint union of the two spectra. However, it's not the topological direct sum, as the topology is somehow, these topologies are somehow glued. I mean, it's similar to the one-point compactification. If A1 is just the constants, constant functions, then we, of course, the one-point compactification is just the original space plus infinity. However, this point infinity is somehow glued to the original space. And this way one gets for the embedded loop quantum gravity, loop quantum cosmology configuration space R plus the Bohr compactification. Now the task is to find measures on that space. Please, next slide. To find measures is quite important because then, as John already said, one gets immediately states. And of course, how to choose these measures? That's a big deal because first, there's no continuous group structure on R bar that extends the standard group structure on R. Therefore, there's no Haar measure. However, the Borel algebras of R and R Bohr, their direct sum forms the Borel algebra on R bar. Therefore, we can determine the measures separately on these two ingredients. And this was the idea, or John mentioned, to take just the Bohr measure, and then one can just include the standard LQC kinematics. Or as Max, when he was my PhD student, he just took some convex combination of some measure on R and on the Bohr compactification. But the best idea was to take some invariant measures, and this has been done extending the R action of R to R bar. And it was even possible to classify all the invariant finite Radon measures now. If we take the full translation invariance, then we just get the Haar measure on R Bohr, or if we take the dilations, then we get all convex combinations of the Dirac measure at zero, the Dirac measure at zero within the Bohr part, and the Haar measure. This is the very brand new result of John and Max from last week. And they prove even more. They showed that this Haar measure is the only normalized Radon measure on R bar that is dilation invariant and admits some nicely behaving momentum operator. And this is a very, very beautiful result. In particular, it's true not just for this R bar in the new sense, I would like to say, but also in the standard case of taking the configuration space, the quantum configuration space, to take just as R Bohr. All these results have been true for homogeneous isotropic cosmology, and let me just mention that there's also some very nice uniqueness result by Abay and Miguel. They proved a unique that there is a unique cyclic state on the reduced Y algebra that is invariant under these residual diffeomorphisms. This, however, is only true for the, I would say, classical LQC configuration space. Actually, that configuration space in the embeddable framework, I would is not known. So, next slide. And final topic. The question is, can we somehow distinguish whether first reduce and then quantize is different from first quantize and then reduce? And indeed, this is possible using functoriality. As the condition to be embeddable is just a condition using pullbacks, and pullbacks commute, and they commute with concatenations. We see that the quantization of the embeddings, the quantization of the concatenation of the embeddings equals the concatenation of the quantizations of these embeddings. And this allows, if you take the next slide, there just the indices disappear. This just means that the symmetry means we have the invariance of the respective algebra under our symmetry. And next slide. I mean, this is still the same slide, but next click. This then allowed to define invariant quantum configuration spaces and compare to the quantization of the invariant classical quantum configuration space. And as Max has proven, we have always the subset relation of the quantized reduced configuration space within the quantum symmetric configuration space. However, in typical examples, it is a proper subset, and this way we get different configuration spaces depending on which path we take. So quantization and reduction do not commute in general. So my final slide, just 15 minutes. Just let me summarize what we know. Okay, we know how to relate the configuration space on the quantum level and how to lift symmetries to a configuration space. Of course, most examples are homogeneous isotropic, so there's a desperate need of having more examples, of course. Quantization versus reduction is known only in very limited cases. However, there we know it is not given. There are first results concerning uniqueness issues, and we also have first hints how to relate these phase spaces. These are results by John and Max, for instance. As I said, okay, the states have not been defined using a Gelfand triple at the LQC side for their own reason, but typically just to take some with some justification chosen measure on the space there. And of course, as John said, dynamics, this is basically completely unknown. I mean, the relation between the dynamics on the cosmological and the full level. Okay, sorry, I think I'm almost 1.5 minutes or so, 2 minutes over. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, 1.5 minutes is perfectly fine. Are there any quick questions for Christian? Okay, if not, let's go to the last part of the talk, which is going to be given by Emanuele. Emanuele, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, please start. Yeah.
Okay. So, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the opportunity of participating in this panel discussion. Let me start, because 15 minutes not enough to cover all those topics. What I'm going to speak about is this model I developed with Francesco, and this is part of the second line of thinking that Jonathan presented. Namely, here we are thinking to use full loop quantum gravity and then try to implement some kind of reduction at the quantum level. So let's go to slide number 28, the second slide. So what we want to do is to implement on the SU2 kinematical Hilbert space those two equations, the one in the blue box and in the red box, namely this particular form for the connection and the electric field. There is no sum over I in those equations. So our question is, can we implement at the quantum level those two equations? Obviously, if you take the original Poisson bracket, once you implement those conditions, you would end up with those reduced Poisson brackets between P and C. So to do this classically, we consider holonomies along curves that are parallel to those fiducial vectors. And if you look at the SU2 group element that where the connection has the form in the red box, you would have SU2 group elements that would be just generated by the U1 subgroup. And you would have those U1 subgroup, one different for each direction. So this is classically what would mean having equation 1 to impose at the level of holonomies. If we go to next slide, so we want to implement the condition, the blue condition, the condition on the electric field. Once you rewrite this in terms of fluxes, you could just see those flux matrices in terms of direction and internal indexes, and the requirement would be that this matrix is diagonal. This already classically, only having taken into account the particular form for A and E that we want to impose, and this second condition, the blue condition, can be imposed using this second class constraint with the Gauss constraint that I called chi I. So next slide, please. What we tried to do was to try to implement at the quantum level this reduction, the red condition, and on the holonomies, and at the same time impose this second class constraint with the glass constraint, this chi I. Now, I don't have time to give you all the details. What we did was just to implement the spin-form procedure, and this essentially amounts in impose the second class constraint weakly in the Hilbert space, in the SU2 Hilbert space, to find the physical Hilbert space, and then embed U1 cylindrical functions inside the SU2 ones using the technology of projected spin networks. Now, this allow, if you do this procedure, you have at your disposal a projector on what we call physical reduced states, where the two starting conditions hold weakly. Then you can proceed quantizing, projecting also the Gauss constraint and the vector constraint, and you would just get some particular new intertwiners that we call the reduced intertwiners that are nothing else that phases in this U1 to the third theory that you obtain. And you can also consider S-not classes of states that are obtained by group averaging respect to some residual diffeomorphisms that are left once you impose our two main conditions. So we can go to next slide. I just give you a picture of the kinematical states that you obtain that are compatible with our two initial conditions on connection and fluxes. At the kinematical level, you will have some cubular graph where at the nodes you will have some reduced intertwiners, and you can have at each node in each of the three different directions associated with those three principal directions, you can have different spin numbers. Those spin numbers are just U1 spin numbers. So if you want kinematically, there are those states obtained by projection out from the SU2 ones that can represent homogeneous sector of the theory once that you set all the those reduced intertwiners to be equal, and you can have homogeneous and anisotropic or anisotropic sectors once you set all the spins in the three principal directions to be equal, or eventually you can have homogeneous and isotropic sector once you set all the intertwiners and the spins to be equal. This is kinematically, and you can imagine those lattices as floating lattices once you implement also the diffeomorphism constraint. Now, having this reduced kinematic hyperspace space at your disposal, we can go to the next slide number 32, and you can think to how general is this framework. Well, if you look back at the conditions that we imposed, the blue condition in particular is compatible with the requirement that the three metric to be diagonal. Now, the point is that you can diagonalize three metrics in general using 3D homomorphisms. So what we were doing with that condition was actually just a partial gauge fixing of the diffeomorphisms. And it's interesting to note that the same physical Hilbert space that we derived using the spin form procedure can just be derived asking building a metric operator and asking to this operator to be weakly vanishing if you are in the diagonal gauge. Now, the weak solution that you find are exactly the kind of states that I presented you with those graphs. And so the natural question is if this treatment would mean that we are dealing with the loop quantum gravity in diagonal triad gauge. Well, the answer is yes, but this would require a non-trivial Hamiltonian. I have to say that all this kind of the loop quantum gravity in diagonal gauge has been studied also by Norbert, and he finds results that are somehow compatible with our results. What is missing to make this formalism compatible for useful for the full theory would be a non-trivial Hamiltonian, and this non-trivial Hamiltonian could be obtained looking at the work that has been developed in the Warsaw group, where they studied the radial gauge. But at the moment, what we have is enough to describe cosmological model and also in the BKL conjecture. So we can go to slide number 33.
Again, when you say that the Hamiltonian is non-trivial, you mean the quantum Hamiltonian, or you mean already at the classical level you will have some secondary constraints or things like this? Or is just at the quantum level that the gauge may not be preserved?
At the classical level, you would have nasty non-local terms in the Hamiltonian.
You would have secondary constraints in order to preserve this?
Yes. Because what you want, you put the metric in the diagonal form using the 3D homomorphism, but the Hamiltonian is not commuting with this gauge fixing. So you need to add terms to the Hamiltonian to make a new Hamiltonian that now preserves this gauge fixing. So those are the terms you are speaking about. Okay,
thank you.
Okay, but if you neglect the spatial gradients and in the BKL hypothesis, those terms are okay, are not there. So what we are now, I described you the Gauss and the Hamiltonian is missing this description. So we studied the Hamiltonian a la Demann. Having those reduced diffeomorphisms still available in the theory, you can deal with the graph changing or non-graph changing Hamiltonian. We studied the non-graph changing case, and in particular, as first test of consistency for our theory, we studied the expectation value of this Hamiltonian on coherent states. To do this, we took Tiemann coherent states and the usual heat kernel coherent states. And it's just to understand what we are doing, think to those states as Gaussians, in which you have this J0 that codes the intrinsic curvature, the intrinsic geometry, and a phase that codes the intrinsic curvature, more or less C. And so you have on one link those Gaussians that are J0 and C. This in the full theory. Now what we did is to project those coherent states in our reduced Hilbert space and have our semi-classical reduced state, one per link. We can go to slide number 34. And what we did was to consider not you could do this on a single cell. What we did instead was to consider collective coherent states in which you make something homogeneous, this box with the same colors in the three directions on the right, making coherent superpositions in the three directions and relating the macroscopic configuration variables to the microscopic ones. Those are related by the number of nodes that are available in your state. We can go to slide number 35. If you do this analysis, you compute the expectation value of this Hamiltonian on those collective coherent states, you get the results that you can see on the right in the blue box. Here there are C, the global C, P, the global P in the three directions, and also the number of nodes appear. Well, if you compare this with the left side in the red box with the Hamiltonian used in loop quantum cosmology, you see that we have exactly the same kind of Hamiltonian once we identify the mu parameter with the inverse of the number of nodes in each of the direction. If you look at the second boxes, also the structure of the regulators of the mu parameter is the same, but there is a key difference. The key difference is that to use coherent states, we use a non-graph changing Hamiltonian. This means that our number of nodes cannot change. So we are namely, even if the permutations, let's say, of these mu parameters is correct, we are in a mu zero scheme. We can go then to slide number 36. This can be better understood looking just at the homogeneous case. We are at slide 36. Look at the expression for P and C. This is related to the phase in the Gaussian and the center of the Gaussian that I called J and theta. If n is fixed and you evaluate the expectation value of the Hamiltonian on those collective coherent states, you get this expression with the sign square, and you see that this is exactly the Hamiltonian of loop quantum cosmology in the mu zero scheme, because the number of nodes is fixed. So formally is okay, but without a mechanism that changes the number of nodes, we cannot reproduce the improved scheme. Our last idea was, can we find some way of reproducing this in the non-graph changing case? Because obviously with a graph changing case this could be possible, because the number of nodes could change. Our idea was to use a statistical approach and implement a density matrix. Why? Because we just used one possible microstate that is compatible with the classical configuration, but varying the number of nodes and varying J and theta, you can reproduce many macroscopic configuration. Now, this varying the number of nodes essentially tries to answer to the question of few big or many small to reproduce something classical or semi-classical in loop quantum gravity. Namely, we need big graphs with many nodes and small many nodes and small quantum numbers, few nodes with large quantum numbers. Well, from our result, we can go to slide 37. Seems that the answer is that you need both. What we did is to consider just a counting of the number of states compatible with those classical configuration and introduce this density matrix with this simple weight Cn. But before proceeding, there is a key observation here that given a fixed value of area, that is P here, J, the quantum number, they have a minimum, and this implies that N has a maximum. Now, given an algebraic graph with an N max number of nodes, if you consider how many smaller graphs are available having at your disposal N max cell, you will see that the binomial is enough to count those states. And if you consider the the trace of this density matrix with our microscopic Hamiltonian on this the trace with this density matrix, you will find that the result is this. Is this function that depends on C, but now also depend on N max. Essentially, the binomial becomes a Gaussian, and the Gaussian is peaking on N max half. And if you plug back the relation between this maximum number of nodes and P, you find that the dynamics you describe is exactly the one that you used that you use in the improved scheme. So somehow, even without a graph-changing Hamiltonian, using a kind of gas of coherent states that are compatible with the classical configuration, you can recover the improved scheme. So I'm already 2 minutes late. So just last slide. What we have to do with this approach, I think that we showed a link with Loop quantum cosmology. This is not at the level of embedding kinematical Hilbert space and looking at their mathematical underlying structure. It's just to take the full theory, use a kind of truncation at this moment because the non-local terms in the Hamiltonian are missing, but a truncation that then is compatible and enough to reproduce cosmology, and implement those symmetry reduction at the level of gauge fixing, and select some particular states and work with those states. And the effective dynamics of loop quantum cosmology can be recovered. Now, obviously, the link to the phenomenology has to be studied, and also the link to the other proposal to extract the cosmology from the full theory, namely spin-form cosmology from theory, can be analyzed. But this, in general, is also an arena for the canonical theory. So I think that's all. Thank you.
Okay, so Jonathan gave us the introduction, and then Christian filled in the more details about the kinematical part, and Emanuele has told us about what is achieved already for the dynamics. So now we can have questions to all three of them. We can start in any order. You can ask more conceptual questions, more technical questions, or whatever you like. Please start.
So, Abhay, I have first a very small question for Emanuele, because I'm slightly confused about one thing in his talk. The results are very interesting. Like, what I missed in Emanuele's talk is that he takes coherent states which are peaked both on the intrinsic curvature and the extrinsic curvature. So, but then somehow magically, like, instead of getting a Bianchi 9 or Bianchi 2 kind of a Hamiltonian constraint, he gets a Bianchi 1. So I would like to understand what happened to the intrinsic curvature in his model.
No, I took, if we go to slide number, I don't know, maybe that slide, 1 second, I lost, slide number 34. Here I took coherent states that have the same C and the same C and the same P in each direction. So I am picking on an isotropic homogeneous configuration. Then I take the expectation value of the Hamiltonian on this configuration. What is missing? Hello?
So I'm sorry, like I think,
yeah, so what in on the slide
saying,
on the slide which is like study the Hamiltonian a la Thiemann,
yes,
so you have like this J L, which codes the intrinsic geometry. What happened to this intrinsic geometry?
The intrinsic geometry is coded in the mean value of the Hamiltonian, namely on this it's this J0 or J-bar in the slides I presented. This is the center of the Gaussian, right? I pick on three different J, one per direction. So this is picking around three different P. So let's say PX, PY, and PZ, those red color, blue color, red color, and blue, red, and green color. So at the same time, I pick on three different values of the extrinsic geometry, on three different values of C, one per direction.
Okay, and your intrinsic geometry is flat?
In this case, yes.
Okay. Thank you. So, if you allow me, like, I have one common question both to Emanuele and Jonathan.
Please go ahead.
Okay, so Jonathan stressed a couple of times in his talk that we should not be imposing symmetry by imposing invariance. And he also showed us very nicely that since we are dealing with the second class constraints, like the naive way to just promote them to operators and acting on the states will also not work, and we have to do either Gupta-Bleuler kind of quantization or we have to handle master constraints, and there are issues of ambiguities there, what answer we get. Now, if I understand correctly, like the way Emanuele has done is essentially by imposing invariance and then using some conditions in the EPRL model. My question to both of them is that, to Jonathan first, is that does he agree that this is probably not what he would like to be done when obtaining Bianchi 1 spacetime from loop quantum gravity, because it's not done the way he thinks is correct? And secondly, like my question to Emanuele is that when we impose this condition in the APRL model, which I have very limited knowledge of, what exactly we are doing? Are we promoting these equivalent of the second class constraints to operators and then trying to find the physical Hilbert space or something else?
Okay, so maybe it is actually easier if Emanuele went first, because then he will explain what he is doing and then Jonathan can tell whether he is happy or not.
Okay, yes, thank you.
Okay, so I start. So yes, we take the second class constraint, we promote it to an operator, and we ask a master constraint version of it to be zero, strongly on the states, and this implies that the linear version of the second class constraint is satisfied weakly, a la Gupta-Bleuler. And this selects in the full Hilbert
slide
space
30,
a subspace. What? This selects
everybody
a subspace.
Slide 30.
This is what I call physical Hilbert space. It's exactly like in spin form. You want to impose the simplicity constraint, and those are imposed as second class, those are second class. You take a quadratic version of it, you impose it, and then you have that the linear simplicity constraint are satisfied weakly. And this essentially amounts to the reduction, if you want, from SLQC to SU2. And what I'm doing is just the same story, one dimension less, with a reduction from SU2 to U1.
Okay.
Jonathan?
Well, I mean, I think Emanuele is using coherent states, right? And so really this is how he's handling. So I mean, I think what Emanuele was just describing is how he does the, imposing the U1 gauge fixing constraint. And of course, that also involves imposing second class constraints, both the appropriate component of the Gauss constraint and the U1 gauge fixing condition. But I think that Param was more referring to imposing symmetry on the configuration and momenta. And as far as I can tell, the way Emanuele does this is he just using coherent states.
Yeah, the second part no, because he asked about the simplicity constraint. So the kinematical construction is with the spinform technology, and this is with the Gupta-Bloiler procedure. Now, the way, so I have kinematical states, but I cannot say that those kinematical states are homogeneous or isotropic because I have no criterion. But probably the criterion should be to check if my kinematical states satisfy your the condition that you wrote, that Jonathan wrote. This is a test that I didn't do. But what I can do is on the top of those states is to, that a priori have arbitrary quantum numbers, I can take superposition, and those are with coherent states. And with those coherent states, I can force the homogeneity and the isotropy. So yes, John is correct. The homogeneity and the isotropy is then imposed at the level of coherent state. While at the kinematical level, I'm just imposing the states to be compatible with this local condition on E and C and A.
So it is true then that even before we construct the coherent states, there are symmetries imposed at the configuration space, and this is what Jonathan was objecting to.
In the configuration. There is a gauge fixing only,
okay,
at the quantum level, let's say.
Right.
I mean, there is a gauge fixing, and there is the fact that I'm neglecting some special derivatives to have the A in the diagonal form. But this is one limitation of the theory as it is. It's why it's not the full theory in diagonal gauge. But at the quantum level, I'm just imposing diagonal gauge. So that's why I have graphs that at different nodes have different quantum numbers. I'm just saying that looking at them seems natural to say the homogeneous sector is when all the nodes have the same intertwiner and all the links in the have the same quantum numbers. But I don't have a criterion to say those are the quantum states that satisfy homogeneity. But what I'm sure of is that I can make coherent states to make them homogeneous, because I can ask them to be homogeneous with superposition.
Can I ask a technical question on the same thing to Emanuele? You still have a U1 gauge invariance at the nodes, right?
No.
There's no more U1, not even U1 gauge invariance at the nodes. Everything has been gauge fixed.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Okay, so Paramat, so the short answer is that Emanuele is using, imposing both those constraints, and they have been imposed, quote unquote, a la Gupta-Bloiler, or using coherent state methods, which really is taking into account the fact that they're second class, and that is not being violated.
Okay.
That part is being done correctly.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Other questions? Okay. Jonathan, I have a question. I couldn't understand something that you said, which had to do with, let me just tell you what transparency it is. It has to do with your work with Chris and somebody else. Yeah, I think it's slide 13.13. Okay. Can you explain the equations? I mean, I had difficulty in understanding what was I and T and EAI. I is really square root of minus 1, or?
Yeah, exactly. Square root of minus 1. So this bold A, that's just, it's the complexification of the real connection, just using a volume as your complexifier. So this is like your annihilation operator. This is where the Gupta-Bloiler element is coming in. And then we really impose the homogeneity and isotropy on this complexified connection, which is then enough to imply homogeneity and isotropy on both configuration and momenta. And T is a parameter. So this
but in this definition of V of F, it seems that there are indices which are floating, right? And V as itself doesn't have any indices.
point. I suppress them.
So the smearing function that you feed into B is matrix valued.
Right. So V also is a matrix valued.
So we define V so that the smearing function is matrix valued, but we just end up taking the trace of the smearing function and defining V of F. We just define it that way because it's the way S is defined.
Okay. Sorry, I just missed that it's II and not IJ. Okay, and then, so you're saying that you're imposing a constraint in which the final answer... you're imposing a quantum constraint, so although it is imposed on just the configuration variable, it also ensures that the momentum is homogeneous and isotropic. Is that what you're saying? Oh.
That's right, because it's really a condition on. It's clear that the condition involves both the connection and the triad. It involves the triad directly in the appearance of the volume, and also in the triad and the expression for B. And the triad also appears in the expression for the complexified connection. In fact, it is enough to imply homogeneity and isotropy of both. One interesting thing is that it implies homogeneity. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Please finish.
One interesting thing is that it implies homogeneity and isotropy in some coordinate system, in some gauge. And it doesn't even select whether you're in the spatially flat case or the spatial, or whether it's the positive intrinsic curvature or the negative intrinsic curvature case. All of these three cases are all included in the solutions to this constraint.
So then to get something like what Emanuele and told us today about, then one would have to put some additional information, right? In other words, to talk about a physical model, either Bianchi 1 or as Param was saying, Bianchi 9, you'll have to put an additional condition to select out that particular sector.
That's true, yeah. So in Emanuele's case, it should satisfy this condition approximately in some way. But in addition, it should also satisfy the condition which says that you're in a spatially flat model. That's an additional condition.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Do you see that there's a difficulty? I mean, I would have thought that it was, I don't mean easy, but clear calculation to see if, in fact, Emanuele is doing this or not, right?
I'm not sure. I haven't really looked at it. But
in principle, one could take your yellow and blue equation in slide 13 and test if the states I built satisfy those conditions or not, because. Those difficult operator, one should build those operator B and V in my theory, but I think it's a test that could be done.
Sure. You'd probably regularize the curvature in a way using the graph.
Yes, regularize, and then I just use in all my construction just elements of my reduced Hilbert space and operators acting there, and try to see if because these, for example, the F wedge E of your B operator F wedge E is just the Hamiltonian constraint, right? Somehow,
it's
no.
It's close to the Hamiltonian constraint. That's right. It's like untraced, so that instead of having the lap, you have a matrix value smearing function.
Yeah, it's not the trace. But in principle, one could write an expression for it and see it as an operator.
That's right. You can quantize
and
it the same way.
V is the volume, right? V is just the volume.
Huh?
V of F, V okay. is the volume,
I think we all agree that this could be done, but it's not trivial, but it's something that is, there's no conceptual issue.
It's not trivial because the operators are different, but could be done.
No, it's not trivial, right. Let me just go back and say something else, which is that Jonathan also stressed that somehow one doesn't have much of a control or some comment about the spin foam models, that, you know, one doesn't know how to do dynamics in loop quantum cosmology or something like that on spin foam models. Whereas Alessi actually in the last transparency had references to spin foam models directly. So there seems to be like somewhat of a tension here, and maybe Jonathan can start by saying what he thinks is missing, because I know that Jonathan knows these things very well.
Yeah.
Discussion that Alessi had in the last transparency on the spin foam models.
I mean, I believe Emanuele, he's using the same sort of methods that we use in the EPRL model to impose the second class constraint. And I think he's just using the same sort of method. So he's using it to impose his U1 gauge fixing condition. It's not really that he's using spin foam dynamics. He's just using a method which was used in the EPRL model. Is that right, Emmanuel?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I was not using the EPRL vertex to code the dynamics. The dynamics for me is some version of Tiemann Hamiltonian constraint. In particular, I tested the non-graph changing. Now one could try to see if an exponentiated version of this Hamiltonian corresponds to the PRL vertex that has been used to spin foam cosmology. This is a project to do. Not easy, but in principle one could try to look at this. But I never used explicitly the spin foam dynamics. I just used the spin foam techniques to impose the second class constraint.
Right. So I guess the question to Jonathan was, I'm sorry, I'm trying to find the place in the strategies when you explicitly said...
Slide six, maybe?
Okay.
But Abel, like, just a very small comment. I do not remember, like, in the spin foam cosmology, whether when we studied the Bianchi models, which I think David Sloan studied in one of his papers, whether the improved dynamics was even implemented. I think that is still an open issue there. So there is more work here apart from just exponentiating and then trying to find that vertex amplitude. So I think like we still have to do some more work on the spin foam cosmology side to make a connection with what Emmanuel is doing.
Okay.
The
question really is to going back to Jonathan on his slide six. In the first part of the slide six, you say that spin foam cosmology has so far not tried to make contact with LQC. Making contact between spin foam cosmology and LQC is an open issue, and I just wanted you to elaborate a little bit on this. Is it something more than what Param is saying, or is it what Param was saying?
So there is this work that was done reformulating LQC in a form which is more similar to spin foams. There's also, of course, there's spin foam cosmology, but as far as I'm aware, in spin foam cosmology, people have been concerned with reproducing the Friedman equations to leading order, and they haven't really concerned themselves with making contact with LQC. That's what I mean. So, and with regard to the reformulation of LQC in a way that's more similar to spin foams, again, there's no contact yet to the EPRL model or some other full theory spin foam dynamic model. So this is what I mean, is that there isn't. There's some progress, but they're not touching yet from the two sides.
Okay. Is there any other question? Because time is going to run out pretty soon on us. So please pick up if you have any other questions.
In particular, if you have a question for me, because my lecture starts in 5 minutes.
Okay, so let me just summarize and say one remark.
Yeah.
The remark that I want to make is that there were a lot of comments in the, both by Christian and by Jonathan about, you know, open issues, and I think it's very, very important to keep track of these open issues. But I think the kind of thing that is being done, which is really partial gauge fixing, and then going to quantum theory, which is what was being done in Emmanuel's talk, I think that is really quite valuable. I mean, in other approaches to quantum gravity, people just routinely take for granted that gauge fixing and imposing the constraint, if you like, they are equivalent if you do gauge fixing correctly, or something like that. So I think that we should not sort of be, we should be aware of the things that we have to be doing, but we should not sort of say, well, but that's not kosher, you should not gauge fix. I think that one should just, if one can make progress by gauge fixing, one can gauge fix and see what you get, and keep in mind that one still has some work to do, but not, so to say, they have not done much at all vis-a-vis the full theory. I mean, most other approaches, as I said, in fact, many, many times, the whole theory is just solved by gauge fixing. For example, mathematical physics community, when they solve QCD in low dimensions, it is very often done completely by gauge fixing and not really in a gauge invariant way. So I think that is not something that is as fatal as one might a priori think. Any other comments?
I agree with
okay,
you.
Okay, so let us thank the panelists again. And I guess this is the last ILQG for the academic year. So let us thank the LHC group and Jorge in particular for hosting this and taking care of all this.
Thank you.
Okay, back to you, Jorge.
Okay, it's over. Thanks.